Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture, and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome. You're listening to New Books in Gender Studies. I'm your host, Shohini Chatterjee, and I'm a PhD student in Gender, Sexuality and Women's Studies at Western University. And I'm delighted to be in conversation today with Dr. Rana M. Jalil on her new book, Work of Rape, published by Duke University Press in 2021. Dr. Jalil is Associate Professor in the Department of Gender, Sexuality and Women's Studies at the University of California, Davis. As a member of Writers for the 99%, she co-authored Occupying Wall Street. Work of Rape is the recipient of Duke University Press Scholars of Color First Book Award. Many congratulations and welcome to the New Books Network, Rana.
Oh, thank you very much. It's nice to be here, and you have such a lovely podcast voice. I'm hoping I don't stutter too much.
Thank you. Thank you very much for being here and speaking with us today. Could you begin by telling us a little bit about how this book was conceived and what motivated you to undertake this intellectual journey that led you to bringing this book to us?
Sure. I think I've been thinking about this for a really long time. I was in high school and then in college in the mid-90s. I'm telling my age now, but at that time, there was both the news that was happening in the former Yugoslavia's disintegration and the rape camps and the idea of mass rape. And there was also a kind of what gets called third wave feminism in the U.S. And this kind of emphasis on Take Back the Night that was really resurgent, and a lot of the feminist media that I saw around that time was really focused on sexual violence. That wasn't by accident. That had been an organizing rubric for the movement that had started some decades back, and to try and consolidate and form kind of a feminist plan or agenda. So what happened was I was living in that moment, and I was reading things about rape and wartime conditions, and I was also going to feminist activist meetings and movement building spaces where rape was being talked about as the absolute worst thing that could happen to a woman in particular. That was the language used at the time. And I started trying to think through the connections. For me, it really, when I was that young, the question was really pretty simple and unsophisticated. It was, if rape is the worst thing that can happen to you, how do we talk about being in a rape camp or rape and work? It seemed like there were differences. And I wasn't, at that point, I didn't really know how to think about them. So I kept researching. That was when I started researching to try and figure out that question. And of course, the question changed. As I did research, as I entered a graduate program, you know, it changes based on what discipline you're working in. The question takes on different shapes based on what knowledge formations you want to address and you want to engage with. So it changed quite a bit from that, and I'm glad it did. But that was the initial kind of impulse. It came out of trying to make sense of the world and being in organizing and activist spaces.
Mm-hmm. In the Work of Rape, you have developed a queer method, which you call Law Beyond Law. Could you tell our audience what this method is and the significance it holds for your book?
Sure. So the idea of Law Beyond Law, it's a little L. It's hard to communicate it. I think speaking, it works better on the page, but it's a little L law beyond big L law. So the idea is that law carries a lot of weight and authority. There are ways to address law that speak about it on its own terms and logic. So, for example, following a history of law that talks about what decisions, what legal decisions or what case law, for example, has been produced on a certain subject, right? So around sexual violence, for example, or around race. And with the little L law, I wanted to think more about the production of law itself. And there are people who, like Siobhan Somerville, who think about reading sideways, so embedding law within its historical moment, for example, to look at the kinds of histories and motivations that are provoking some of the decisions, and to think about precedent in that way. And I wanted to build on that. I also wanted to think about how the structures and logics of law itself even inform the kinds of decisions that that come out, or ways that we think about single issues, because there are other structures, legal structures and legal concepts in place that are shaping their meaning. So, for example, consent and coercion. There are larger debates around this about autonomy, rape in general, and the idea of RAS and the idea of mass rape, what that can mean in the context of war. If you're looking to charge an international crime, it's going to be shaped and constrained by the other violations that rape and sexual violence get nested within. So crimes against humanity, genocide, or war crimes. And those kinds of structures shape what's possible to imagine. And they also come out of those ideas of violation and the ability to prosecute or name and describe these kind of violations through law activate all sorts of political investments and political strategizing that can operate very unevenly in a divided world and in a world where colonialism and imperialism and the legacies of them are still very active.
Absolutely. I'm also intrigued as to how this queer method enabled you to be in conversation with queer of color critique, international scholarship on race making, and queer feminist activist scholarship to explore the interconnection between law and its codification of sexual violence. I was wondering if you have any thoughts on that.
Sure. So a lot of queer of color critique is really about thinking about the inherited gaps, or this is how I perceive it, to think about what kind of gaps that we inherit, or what kind of thought that we inherit that doesn't get questioned even in revolutionary thought. So I'm thinking a lot about Rod Ferguson's introduction, for example, to Aberrations in Black, and his work to make clear how Marx, for example, keeps some categories around family, around gender and sex intact, even as he critiques others in liberalism. And so having been a student of queer of color critique and read a lot about it in general, one of the things I was thinking about is how its emergence in the 1990s is first, and this is not a bad thing, right? It's just something to observe. It's U.S. based. It's not thinking transnationally. And the idea of what sexual freedom might mean as a result isn't engaging with the kinds of things that are happening at that same moment. The queer of color critique is kind of being born in queer theory, and queer studies are being kind of born out in the academy, which is the fall of communism, the so-called post-socialist moment, and the advent of ethnic warfare. So I'm trying to kind of think of all those things together to see what that does about ideas of value and property and that sort of thing. And I thought someone was going to keep the dog out of here, but a little dog just wandered in. I hope he doesn't bark.
You write that efforts to create legally identifiable sexual harms lead to the standardization of consent and coercion. Could you reflect on the dangers of such standardization?
Well, I think some of the danger, I would take it back a step. It's that consent and coercion themselves, the way that they're understood, is often in a very individuated way. So your consent is violated in an individual level in a sexual violation, or you feel coerced. And what doesn't get interrogated as a result are some of the larger structural the larger structural questions about formations of desire, what we like, what we don't like, and then also just the grounds that we're living on and how we move through them, and how we live on them. So how do we think about sexual consent and coercion when, for example, we're in a settler colonial space? How do we think about how consent and coercion, sexual consent and coercion, particularly as sexual violence becomes a kind of rallying cry to unite a certain kind of wing or strand of feminisms? You know, what does that do to other kinds of violation that can't factor in, and other experiences of sex and of sexual violence or harassment or rape that can't factor into, that can't, you know, where the experiences are racialized or are about, you know, very much about being colonized, and how those don't factor into the violation or the understanding of sexual harm itself, except as kind of an add-on. They become proof of coercion or proof of sexual harm, but they're not kind of theorized from that kind of perspective, location, or place.
Right. You write that the method of law beyond law destabilizes progressive notions of history, time, and social group formation, and pushes against the standardization of consent as being the most relevant indicator of sexualized violence. Could you expand on this and comment on how it allowed you to interrogate structural violence validated by the law?
Okay, so in the intro, when I'm talking about the method, one of the things that lets me do is think about the idea of fraud, of rape by deception, which in legal scholarship provoked a lot of debate, because it was a way of if the core violation, and this is kind of how law thinks about this, of rape is a violation of autonomy, then why are there not prohibitions against rape by deception in general? And so some of the cases that people wrote about where rape by deception where there were charges of rape by deception, you know, just as kind of an example of it, involved cases in occupied Palestine. And so the argument there was just that, look, you know, here we've got this example where, you know, the situation's politically fraught, but we have someone claiming to be something they're not. We have someone who's an Arab claiming to be Jewish, and this is and if the woman had known, then this sex wouldn't have been consented to. And so it's turning all around this idea of fraud that doesn't go back in any way and account for what's happening in the world, what's happening on the land, what's happening to make that experience of consent and coercion something that is even recognizable. So one of the ways to think about, one of the things that the method tries to do is think about again, like those other kinds of, the other kinds of movements of law and the other movements of history, and just things that fall out of a kind of straight legal analysis, to just bring up what other kinds of structural violence get hidden or obscured by charges of sexual violation sometimes. So that's I wrote about that in the intro a little bit, but it comes up all through the book, but that particular example is in the introduction.
Yeah. You also write about the racialization of mass rape. Would you like to reflect on the politics of racialization, love mentality, and the production of the category of failed states, thought to be in dire need of intervention, and its gendered, sexualized, and raced implications?
Sure. So I'm following theorists of race who are thinking about race as something that isn't fixed in the body. It's something that changes in all sorts of ways over time. So it's not a completely fixed or obvious identity necessarily. Now it can be, but the way that it works politically is tracking how that changes over time. So what the racialization of mass rape, it's trying to think about what it means that mass sexual violence and becomes such a kind of flashpoint in the 90s, to the point that it becomes part of international human rights. It's prosecuted in ad hoc tribunals and the emergent international criminal court. It starts to take on this kind of like sexual violence as a concept, and particularly mass sexual violence or ethnic rape become terms that, you know, really hadn't been tossed around a lot popularly before. These were not the traditional ways of describing rape. So part of what happened in this moment, and I talk about this in the book, is that some of that kind of popularization of mass sexual violence depended on an idea of mass, of not just mass rape, but also mass ethnic conflict and and sexual violence within it. This fit certain pre-established categories of law, like genocide, like crimes against humanity. So they're shaping what I'm kind of arguing, and it's not causal, right? It's not like one thing causes the other, but you get a kind of atmosphere where the way that one would describe genocide or crimes against humanity is inflecting how mass sexual violence gets rendered, because people want them addressed in this forum. They want them addressed in some way. And international law, which had been kind of suspect during the era of decolonization, at this moment becomes seen as a side of justice, at least by some people. And so there's a push to narrate what's happening in ways that would be cognizable to it. And so I'm thinking about some of the effects of that. Some of the effects of that when we're thinking about the racialization of mass rape is that you end up with legal mechanisms and ideas about rape that, again, are in a very uneven, politically uneven world where power isn't evenly distributed. So when we say mass racial rape or mass ethnic rape, we might think, for example, of the Congo or Rwanda or the former Yugoslavia in the 90s. But generally, people don't think about U.S. prisons, for example, or what happens at the borders of the U.S., the kind of sexualized violence that happens at the borders with migrants. It's, you know, those aren't considered, those don't become mass violations. And this has something to do, I think, with the structure of law itself.
Right. You write in chapter 2 of your book that feminist and nationally produced U.S. or international feminist legal knowledge on mass sexualized violence largely depends on unrecognized and silenced conceptualizations of race, indigeneity, and what you call the sexual state form. Would you like to tell us what you mean by the sexual state form, and how does this conceptualization lead you to interrogate theoretical limitations of sexualized harm?
Okay, so one of the things that I'm thinking about with this idea of the sexual state form is just, it's a heuristic, so it's not meant to describe everything in a lot of detail, but it's just kind of a tool or a device to think about what legal feminists in the U.S., when they're trying to push sexual violence into what's called at the time women's rights, into international human rights law and international law in general, how they're working to think about the language that law will be able to hear. How do you think about sexual violence in a way that makes it a human rights violation or makes it any other kind of violation of international law? So part of what is part of what I'm tracing in the 80s and in the 70s, what happens right before the ethnic wars, is feminist organizing in the Americas around U.S. intervention in Latin America, and feminist organizing with all sorts of groups at the Encuentros, including indigenous groups, including international like feminists who work with international organizations, but also law on the ground and local groups. They're all meeting at these meetings called the Encuentros. So this is in chapter 2, like you said. So what happens when you see, right, all of these different kinds of theorizations of what sexual violence might mean from these different locations, but you know, what the legal feminists get out of this is an argument for sexual, for domestic violence as torture that gets analogized to the kinds of torture that dictators and states visit on political prisoners. So there's a lot of slippage in, there's a lot of slippage that's happening there between the politics, right, of these dictatorships, how they're like, what kind of imperialistic involvement there is in propping them up, the U.S. interference in the hemisphere. All of these kind of things are going into producing a political prisoner and a subject of that of torture in that way. But the move that gets erased when the move is to analogize domestic violence to torture, where women live in a parallel state of terror in which men are like the state. That's one of the arguments that gets made. So it was interesting to me to think about how the political read of what's happening in that region is influencing the way that sexual violence or sexual harm or domestic violence and intimate violence in general get described and get re-narrated.
Right. Your work offers possibilities of understanding race, gender, capitalism, and sexual violence and justice. Why do you think this is important to bring this together, and what does it allow you to understand about law, feminism, particularly legal feminism, and sexual violence?
So I think what's important is to break out of these individuated and individualizing models of sexual violence, and also to break sexual violence association with certain kinds of racial stereotypes and regional stereotypes. I think we've seen for a long time how sexual violence can be used as an alibi to justify all sorts of other kinds of violences, from invasions in Afghanistan to calls to increase policing at home. And so one of the things I try to do in the book is to think about how these circulating ideas of what constitutes sexual consent and coercion, for example, are pulling together, kind of formed through all these different sites of violence from violence in Latin America to the so-called ethnic wars in the former Yugoslavia and Rwanda moves across the globe. And we get this idea of what consent and coercion can mean through US-based largely, but we can just say people working in traditions of European law, maybe, and US-based law, that we get these definitions of what sexual coercion and consent can be that are kind of culled together they're kind of pulled together and culled together from all these discrete sites where sexual violation is happening to the body, but the way it translates into law becomes something where it's happening to all women, and the discrete the situations that people find themselves in, you know, again, like under conditions of colonialism or empire or war, that shape the meaning of that kind of sexual violation fall out. And what we get instead is a global problem of sexual violence that, you know, the U.S. in particular as a watchdog of democracy and all of that kind of self-posturing has to address. So that's one of the things I'm thinking about in the book. And I think that this is one way that we might start trying to think about how when the UN, and this is again something that's written a lot of people have written about how rights and how liberalism can be vehicles for capitalism, US empire, that kind of thing. So I was interested in thinking about how these discussions of sexual violence and consent and coercion could also be those kind of vehicles globally. And then also, again, how that kind of work reverberates back onto US campuses as well, or US spaces. So what happens when, you know, what are the impacts of, you know, post-Cold War orders of global security and governance on the meaning of sexualized violence, And then also, how does that work with in the U.S. itself, which has large issues and a long legacy of disavowing enslavement, indigenous dispossession, and racialized violence? What do these moves allow in the U.S., even as they're something that's extended and understood as something that's happening on a global stage?
In the book, you interrogate legal, feminist, and political theorizations of states sovereignty and responsibility to understand how they render militarized, mass sexualized violence against certain marginalized groups invisible. Would you like to reflect on how this invisibilization and silencing has been normalized and how it has contributed to epistemic, structural, and sexualized violence?
Okay, so some of this is also about just structures of international law, I think you're asking about. So, and a lot of this is about jurisdiction. So law, international law is kind of famously understood as not necessarily having, and this is the words they use in the legal descriptions all the time, it doesn't have any teeth, meaning that its enforcement mechanisms are paltry at best. So when there are things like charges by the International Criminal Court for things like mass sexualized violence there, or these tribunals in the former Yugoslavia and Rwanda, this can only happen when certain states are rendered weak enough and not considered capable of governing on their own, right? They're thought of basically as failed states. So the criteria for jurisdiction is already kind of, you know, for jurisdiction under these terms, rapist, genocide, mass sexual violence, crimes against humanity, those, the kind of territory of those former charges in practice ends up impacting states that, and regions and peoples that are not necessarily well positioned within the geopolitical order. And, you know, the U.S. is a powerful state, and the U.S. is not something that would be that would really be caught up in those nets in those nets of law in the same way, maybe rhetorically, but not in a, but not in, not that we've seen in a way that, like in a material way. So this is part of what, you know, this is part of what I'm thinking about too, is how, when we recognize instances of mass sexualized violence or hear things about like rapist genocide or crimes against humanity and warfare, we're also operating on the terrain where that can be made visible, right? So there's certain kinds of actions made by certain kinds of people that could provoke mass attention to those kinds of charges, and then there are other things that are not popularly understood as mass sexual violence, as genocide. And there's a lot of literature too, right? Critiquing like the language of law and how law in and of itself in trying to define genocide, for example, or war crimes as located in this, as like events that just happen once and they have like a beginning and an end, and not how that language or that idea or understanding of how violence works is incredibly faulty because the impacts of it reverberate for so long and there's something that people live with for a long time. So I'm concerned about all of that. And I'm concerned about what it means for organizing and for feminist organizing in particular to take up sexualized violence without thinking through necessarily how the structures that would make it visible that you can use, you know, what they're also going to leave out or what they're also going to efface. And so I think it's really difficult, and I'm not into a politics of purity. So, you know, people use rights all the time, and they use them in some ways that are great and can be helpful, and they use them in some ways that aren't so useful, in my opinion. So, I think this is one of the things that we need to have a lot more careful thought and dialogue on.
Absolutely, yeah. I realize we are almost nearing the end of this episode, but before we let you go, would you like to tell us what you're currently working on?
Oh yeah, I'm working on this is so funny that you're asking this question. I'm working on two books. One is an autoethnography and kind of mixed genre project on my own family, which is mixed race, part of the Muslim Indian diaspora on one side, and then poor white working class on the other. And so I'm writing a piece that called Animals in the Tree that thinks about working class whiteness, the Muslim diaspora, the U.S. South's black and white race binary, and ask the question of how do we understand race and justice and that kind of, and all those kinds of good things when you already have an animal in the family tree, when you're racialized already through this language and growing up in certain ways around animals and animality. My father is a veterinarian, so that was so that's a more personal project, but I think it's an exciting one. And then I have more straight up kind of legal and queer theory projects as well. One of them is thinking more deeply about these transits that happen with queer of color and trans of color globally, and thinking about what kinds of work, what kinds of configurations of capital or property or power allow the travel of those terms, and then what they can disrupt or what they can enable. So it's thinking again about moving some of these ideas that begin in the U.S. and within U.S. spaces, what it means for them to move globally. So I'm doing a special issue of South Atlantic Quarterly that's on that. And then the last project I'm doing is about race and corporations and thinking about corporate liability in the U.S. context for all sorts of violations, including things that we might call civil or human rights violations, and looking at international, what's happening with, or what happened and is still happening around those issues in both international law and at a couple of sites of grassroots protest. So that's the other book I'm working on.
These are such important projects. I'm particularly interested in your book on autoethnography. I hope to read it. Thank you so much, Rana, for this conversation and for writing a book that we needed. I look forward to getting acquainted with all your upcoming projects, and this was an absolute pleasure.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you so much. It was really nice to talk to you, and I hope I did your questions justice.
You did.